Okay, so this session we're talking about the global economy and the potential ramifications for the financial service industry in Australia. So each speaker will go for about 15 minutes, and we'll have 1 or 2 minutes worth of questions at the end. So I'll introduce the first speaker. I'll introduce both speakers now, actually, and then we'll just go pass from one to the other. So John Edwards, who's the closest speaker to me here, is a visiting fellow at the Lowy Institute, and an adjunct professor with the John Curtin Institute of Public Policy at Curtin University. He's also a member of the Reserve Bank Board of Australia. Amongst other things, his career includes being a director for economic planning and development for the Economic Development Board of the Kingdom of Bahrain, chief economist for Australia and New Zealand for the Global Financial Group, HSBC, and chief advisor of financial markets, Australian Treasury. Our second speaker, Chris Ryan. Chris has worked in the financial services for more than 30 years, with almost half of his career outside Australia in senior management positions in Asia. Most recently, he was CEO and Managing Director for Perpetual Limited in Sydney. Prior to that, he was Head of Asia for Fidelity International Limited, based in Hong Kong. And before that, he was CEO of ING Investment Management Asia Pacific, also based in Hong Kong. He has extensive experience in Asia and has established the first Chinese joint venture fund management company in 2001. So I'll ask John Edwards to come to the stand first. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, and thanks indeed for the invitation to speak to you today. What I wanted was to take literally the theme of this conference, Think Big, and I wanted to, instead of dwelling on quite where we are today, think about where we've come from over the last 20 years and where we may be 10 years hence. What kind of issues are presented by a survey of that kind? And you might well say that given the experience of the last 20 years, it's impossible to talk sensibly about the next 10. After all, in the last 20 years, we experienced the Asia financial crisis, the Russian financial crisis, the long-term capital management crisis, the tech wreck, stock market crash, and the subsequent global recession. And then we had another war in Iraq, and a few years later, the global financial crisis and another steep global recession from which the world economy is still recovering. In those 20 years, we experienced the biggest boom the world has ever seen, and we experienced the sharpest and most difficult downturn since the Great Depression. It's been quite a trip. But the remarkable thing about it, from our point of view here, is that through those two decades, Australia's economic expansion continued. Whatever happened in the rest of the world, we just kept going. This is a very unusual experience for Australia. We had six recessions in the 30 years from 1960 to 1990. And in the last 20 years, we haven't had one. We haven't had one, if you define a recession as two successive quarters during which output falls. In those two decades of our experience, the number of jobs has increased by half as much again. Per capita incomes have also increased by 50%. And total output in the Australian economy is just about doubled. As you can see from that slide, our net worth today, despite it flattening out since the global financial crisis, our net worth today is four times bigger than it was 20 years ago. It's sometimes said that our success has been based on consumption, feckless consumption driven by debt and by home building. But the numbers don't support that. It's true that household consumption has increased as a share of GDP, but it's still around about its average share, not much above it. it's increased about 3% as a share of GDP over the last decade. Home building as a share of GDP has actually been falling since the early years of the last decade. It's widely said that we've only done well because of exports, but in fact, in real terms, that is, in terms of volumes, exports are a smaller share of GDP today than they were a decade ago. Surprisingly enough, mining doesn't explain our success either. This is mining output. Over the whole of the last decade, mining output in Australia has been increasing at much the same rate as the economy as a whole. Mining accounts for 10% of output in Australia today. It accounted for 10% of output a decade ago. It accounted for around about 10% a decade before that. Mining output actually grew more rapidly in the 70s, 80s and 90s than it has over the last decade. The really distinctive and characteristic trend in the Australian economy over the last 12 years is this huge upswing in investment. Business investment a decade ago was around about 10% of GDP. It's just about doubled to nearly 20% of GDP. We have been, since the beginning of the last decade, experienced the biggest investment boom of the last half century. Including home building and government investment, Australia is now investing nearly 30% of its GDP, compared to an average of around about 20% over the whole of the last half century. That means that the growth of investment has contributed three times more than the growth of consumption to the growth of the Australian economy as a whole over the last decade or so. It's certainly true that today a little under half of that investment is in mining, but that's a relatively recent development. In fact, for most of the decade, the preponderance of investment was in industries other than mining. Well, I think this has a few implications if we think of the Australian economy as being, if we think of its main characteristic over the last decade as this huge upswing in investment. It explains quite a lot of what we're most concerned about. That's the pipeline of investment yet to come. So the boom is by no means over. Because investment's been growing so much faster than GDP, it follows that the additional GDP that results from an additional dollar of capital must also have been falling. In other words, capital productivity must have been falling, and that's in fact what's happened. Capital productivity, the additional GDP produced by an additional dollar of capital, has fallen by about a fifth over the last decade. And that in turn is very largely responsible for this, the fall in our multi-factor productivity, which measures the output from a combined input of capital and labour. As the chairman of the Productivity Commission, Gary Banks, says, the investment we've made so far has not been requited by additional output. If our growth of investment had been a little bit slower, we probably wouldn't have had that fall in multi-factor productivity or the slowdown to the same extent in the growth of labour productivity. Well, the main point I'd make about that is that to the extent that productivity growth is weaker because of unrequited capital investment, it will sooner or later pick up, and indeed that may already be evident. So despite the generally bitter and disappointed tone of the Australian public discourse today, we have in fact done very well indeed over the last 20 years. and we continue to do quite well today. Well, let me just switch completely and talk now about where we might be in 10 years' time. I'm going to make some big assumptions here, which I hope are plausible. I'm going to assume that the Australian population, that's net immigration plus natural increase, continues to grow at around its current rate of about 1.5% a year. Now, that, to begin with, is a big ask, because our growth rate of natural increase is going to slow, and at least half of that increase is going to have to continue to come from net immigration over the next decade. I assume that somehow or other, despite an ageing population, we'll be able to sustain the same rate of participation in the workforce. And again, we'll only be able to do that by encouraging older workers to remain in the workforce and by encouraging more women to join the workforce. But if we can do it, then the labour force will also grow at 1.5% a year. And then I assume that labour productivity will come back to grow at around about 1.5% a year, which is a little below its average over the last half century, but well above where it's been over the last decade. That means that if you take those assumptions, and I think they're plausible, they're within our scope, we can get an average rate of growth of 3% a year over the next decade, and an increase in per capita incomes of 1.5%. In other words, over the next decade, we can do nearly as well, not quite as well, but nearly as well as we have for the last couple of decades. But it's going to be quite a big ask. It's going to be quite a big ask, because when you get into the details, you find that it's a very demanding scenario. For example, to get labour productivity of 1.5%, and assuming half of it comes from technological innovation, the remainder has to come from additional capital. And the arithmetic suggests that the additional capital will only be there if we can continue to invest at around about the same rate we're investing now. In other words, we have to do as well over the next decade as we're doing now, and what we're doing now is the best we've done for half a century. To keep our current account deficit under control, we're going to have to save. We're going to have to save as much of GDP as we do now, around about 26%. Again, a very big ask, because our average over the last half century has been around about 20%. So already very demanding. And the final, I think, most demanding aspect of the next decade, if we're going to continue to improve our living standards a little below the rate that we managed to achieve over the last couple of decades, is that our export composition will probably have to change. Now, I say this because it's my expectation that, as the World Bank reported a couple of weeks ago, it's highly likely that China's growth will slow at the end of 10, 12 years from now to around about 5%. And its demand for metals and energy will have slowed to a lower rate of growth, because China will be consuming more and its industrial output will be lower, its investment will be lower. And that means that although Australia will have a huge dividend from increased commodity exports over the next few years, at the end of that period, our commodity exports will probably be growing at around about 3 or 4%. And it follows that if we're going to keep our current account deficit under control, then we're going to have to increase our services component of our exports. And that means, and let me conclude with this point, that the activities of everyone in this room are going to be central to Australia's economic success over the coming decade, because financial services, most vividly the kind of services provided by actuaries are the exemplar of the kind of skills, very high, highly skilled activities that we now need to be selling abroad. Thank you.
So charting a course in stormy weather, that's about what the environment looks like at the moment. And what I've tried to do is not pull too many punches in this presentation, and to be thinking about where we might be going in the context of the rest of the world. Because as Todd Sampson said in that first, the first excellent presentation, one of the things that we have to concern ourselves with is the degree of fear. And I think, again, the dialogue in the Australian amongst the Australian public at the moment is quite a lot about fear, and they have quite a lot to be fearful about. So if we think about, we talk about the Australian two-speed economy and the fact that the mining economy only employs a few hundred thousand people, a relatively small percentage of the workforce compared to the perceptions, both internal and external. And as John said, it's not an overwhelming part of the economy yet. May become a little bit more over the next 10 years, but I also agree that in 10 or 12 years' time, the demand for some of the things that we currently rely on to provide that multiplier effect in the economy may be in lower demand, and so may become a smaller part of the economy. But that's a decade away. What we have to do is make sure that we use the opportunity in the next 10 years and get the bounty that flows from that opportunity wisely, and to start to be thinking about how to increase things like export of services. Now, in terms of financial services in Australia, and it's not directly relating to this slide, but it's an incredibly small proportion of our current total exports. It's about 0.4% of total exports in terms of financial services. It's a very small part, and particularly for, say, non-lending activities, it is a very small part of what we currently do. There are opportunities for us to increase those sorts of exports, but we're not even close to being able to work out how to do that in most circumstances yet. So if we look at those, the two-speed global economy, Western economies, very fragile. You can see the movements in markets, and I'll show you a chart a little in a minute. Very fragile recovery. Investors don't know whether to be fearful, don't know whether the turnaround's already here and they should be investing, putting more risk back on the table, that's resulting in incredible movement of markets on fairly low volume, it has to be said. The unresolved financial crisis in Europe in the last 6 weeks, I've spent two of those weeks in Europe and almost four of those weeks in Asia. I can tell you the European crisis is not going away as far as the Europeans are concerned. Very high levels of unemployment, even in the US where the economy is starting to recover. You've still got relatively high unemployment, and it goes up and down with the month, and the markets go up and down with the announcement of the unemployment number. There's re-regulations, unintended consequences. Again, I'll cover a little bit about that, but by trying to make the world safer for financial institutions, we're also reducing, in some cases, their reaction to any recovery when it comes. And that particularly relates to, say, life insurance companies in Europe. The re-regulation of life insurance companies has led to a very conservative and very high levels of detail required for any market risk that they take on. You would have heard of Solvency II, and that is constraining and requiring them to raise much more capital to be able to prepare for the recovery when it comes. And crisis fatigue, the new or the other Dutch disease. You know, the first Dutch disease is about, is what Australia has at the moment, and we have a very, very high value placed on our currency because of the commodity exports, and that's hurting things like manufacturing and services in terms of being competitive with the rest of the world. Asia, I'm not going to go through that right-hand side, but you know that things are doing better in Asia. And if you look at how the neighbours are actually doing, when I thought about putting up a chart for this, I thought, no, I'm in a room full of actuaries, so numbers would be better than charts. So here you go. And really, you don't need to go through all these numbers, but what it shows is actually the countries in Asia are all relatively similar in terms of where they are. They have solid but not spectacular GDP growth rates with a couple of exceptions. They have central bank rates that are not stressing the economies because real interest rates are pretty low across the region or negative in some cases. And inflation is relatively under control. I mean, I think you can also see from this chart that we actually have relatively high real interest rates relative to the rest, to our neighbours. Now, I'm not drawing any conclusions from that. Maybe that's necessary. But the conditions for growth and stability in a lot of the Asian countries are there. And I'm particularly pleased to look at some of the smaller countries that we don't talk about too much, like the Philippines, for example. It's 90 million people. The Philippines has a history of political instability. Some Western countries are starting to get that reputation too. But I think as far as the Philippines are concerned, the political environment is a lot more stable than it used to be. And instead of going from 7% growth to minus 2 to plus 3 to minus 1 to that kind of trajectory for growth, what you're seeing now in countries like the Philippines is a lot more steady growth, a lot more steady inflation, the central bank doing a better job of keeping the economy under control, better fiscal compliance, and a greater sort of forward momentum in the reform of these economies to become more like Western economies. The euro crisis. Is there a second barrel? Now, if we have anything to fear, this is probably it. The credit crisis that started in 2008 is far from over. Don't believe what you read in the newspapers. Go around and talk to the bankers and the private bankers and the life insurance companies and the pension companies over there and find out if you can find two views that are exactly the same. I couldn't in a couple of weeks. Everybody has a different view. That means people are confused. And so long as they're confused, things are not going to move forward. German industrial production slipped in the first quarter of this year. Germany is the major driver of the Eurozone economies. Now, it slipped because construction slipped, not because they stopped producing BMWs and Mercedes, and that's technically a good thing. But there is fragility in even the German economy, which is the strongest of all of the big economies in Europe. Spanish banks, 8.2% bad debts and climbing. Now, like all situations like this, the mortgage market in a lot of these economies hasn't really hit the bad patch yet. Because people hang on, they sell other assets, they use their savings to keep their home. But in the end, we're going to see a lot more delinquencies in mortgages in Europe before this crisis is over. That will tip into the banks. The banks will need to raise further capital, which means withdrawing from overseas lending, for example. They'll be continuing to sell businesses, but they're going to have to deal with a deteriorating mortgage book. And we may see that in other places as well. You've got 27% unemployment in Spain at the moment. It's phenomenal. And is Italy next? They have a lot of the same characteristics. The Italian economy is a lot bigger than the Spanish economy. But at the end of the day, things in Italy are not looking that great either. And the tipping points could be labour markets. There's a lot of dissatisfaction in Europe right now with this high level of unemployment. People will put up with it for a while, but eventually you get social unrest, and particularly all those unemployed people still vote. So what happens then? You get political backsliding on the reform agenda. And when you get political backsliding, you're starting to see it now in France. Talking to some French people in Hong Kong on Saturday night, who are, you know, senior bankers, and they said there's no doubt that Hollande is going to get in and that some of the reforms that have been agreed to will be wound back. That is not a good thing. And significant escalation in the Eurozone rescue cost, the longer it goes on, the more it costs, the more capital has to be raised, the more support has to be provided, and that's in an environment where the social agenda is starting to change. So, the Spanish flu, again, you're seeing horrendous photos of massive queues in front of employment agencies in Spain, and that chart, which is just really there for the shape more than anything else, a rapid escalation in unemployment in certain European countries. And there are three or four other countries that look like that. So what does this mean for markets this year? Of course, continued volatility, but several worrying issues remain even in the strongest economies. Strongest economies in Europe and in the US, there's still an increase in non-performing loans. I don't know whether we've seen the worst of it in Australia yet, but clearly there are stress in parts of the economy, retail, I'd say residential housing in some cases, and you are starting to see stress creeping in. And as you do, banks will change their lending practices, which means perhaps less money for some of that investment that we need to keep driving the economy in Australia. And while residential market is improving in the US, Europe and Australia do look weaker for different reasons, but they do look weaker than they have been. Investors are not yet rewarded for that volatility. Normally, if you invest in things that are more volatile, you expect to be rewarded more. And while earnings are improving in the US, it's basically a bottom line improvement without much top line improvement, unless you're Apple, of course. But that top line is important. Now, again, more numbers. These are a little smaller, but what this chart shows is that if you took the lowest point of markets, of equity markets, in 2011 and measured them against the 2012 peak so far, actually the picture looks pretty good. It just shows you the amount of volatility in the market. But the decline from that March 2012 peak, and this is about 2 weeks ago, on average is about 6.8%. So almost universally, markets have slid again as more bad news comes out of the Eurozone. And the one-year return, it's sort of an unflattering minus 13% across the globe. So despite the fact that we do see some good signs, this is what people are seeing in one way or another, and this is why the public, even in Australia, is not reacting positively. The better news is around China. I know there's a lot of kind of negativity about where China is at the moment, but having just been there in the last couple of weeks, China is not slowing down from their projections, is what I mean. So they're talking about an 8.2% growth rate in a country as big as China. It's very difficult to do it accurately in a time series. But they've got plenty of juice left. They've got a lot of internal power to boost the economy if they need to, and they have control of all of the levers. China's five-year plan is about go out of China, go west in China, and go green if possible. China's very rarely missed a major five-year plan. Go out of China means invest outside China, and we're seeing a lot of that in Australia, and we'll probably see more. Foreign direct investment, which also drives their economy, is up 5% in the last 2 months. And despite all the press about the Bo Xilai affair, and if you want to talk about that in the break, I'd be happy to, that's not really going to create a major dislocation in the economy. And they're building subways, railways, shopping centres and hospitals in just about every city, habitable city in the country. So there's still a lot of investment, both private and public, going on, and the ability to continue to invest in the economy to keep driving it. The last one there was interesting. Excavator sales, which is one of these odd things that brokers tend to look at, were up again after being down 40% in the beginning of last year. So they're the kinds of things you need to see. Excavator sales are up, which means people are digging holes to put things in them. So the dilemmas for institutions, global institutions and the wealthy, are very long bonds. What happened last time we were all very long bonds? The markets turned and we had a major dislocation in the bond market. So the next asset that is going to have a problem will be the bond market. And that's just because, but it's probably still 18 months to 2 years out before we're likely to see that. And by de-risking one part of the cycle, you're increasing risk in another part of the cycle. As I said, in Europe, most of the insurance companies there have absolutely no assets that are going to respond to the recovery. So can Asia save the world? Well, probably not, but the global economy would be a hell of a lot worse off without the conditions that are currently in Asia. That's steady and constant growth, low debt levels except Japan, and relative stability. We have to expect a significant volatility, and the top line for companies is what's important right now, because a lot of the cost savings, particularly in places like the US that were going to be achieved, have already been achieved. We need a short game In business, we need a short game and a long game to succeed. The short game's got to deal with that near-term volatility, but that long game has to get you back into the growth game when it's available. So as you're thinking about those strategies with yourselves and your clients, be thinking about that. Thank you very much.
Okay, I'll just have probably one question per panellist. John, I mean, we've got, as far as investments that this country makes, is IT investment included amongst that? So is innovative, creative IT investment going to be the way that we're going to get ourselves or sort of replace the manufacturing problem we've got?
Do you?
That should be on. Yeah.
It's on? Yeah. Oh, well, IT investment is certainly included and it's an increasingly important component of Australia's total investment, and it'll have to become more and more important. This is why I think NBN, the National Broadband Network, is a really essential piece of infrastructure for to enable Australia to seize more opportunities in services.
Right. I'll ask you a question, Chris. And I'm aware, John, that you're being on the Reserve Bank, you might not be able to have a view on this one. But certainly, Chris, what do we have to have a surplus this time round? I mean, is it just a political expedient? Are the Asian countries the ones that we should be comparing ourselves with?
I think we do, but we have to engage differently with Asia. And I think those people who might have heard me speak on this topic before, we don't actually engage very well. We try and engage one, you know, Asia to Australia. There is no Asia. Asia is a Western fabrication. It's a word that we use to classify those countries. So it has to be one-on-one. And one of the things that I did hear from the industry, from a senator actually, who said to me, we're so good at superannuation fund administration, surely we must be able to export that service, superannuation fund administration. But to cut to the quick here, the truth is that what we do, superannuation fund administration is about 90% Australian tax administration and 10% account keeping. That is not exportable. Sorry. So we have to find other things to do.
So should we not be outsourcing? With the banks outsourcing to low-cost countries, is that actually working against us?
We have to go up the value chain to higher value-added services, and there is plenty of demand for the things that we do in Australia, but we are not engaging in the right way. I've just spoken with a company last week, and I'm speaking to their board this week, who've done a joint venture with a Chinese company. They've done it very quickly, but they, you know, when I talk to them, they're probably only 10% of the time is about how they're going to reap the benefits, the commercial benefits of that partnership, and it's going to be quite difficult for them. I think what we need to do, you asked about the surplus. I think that if we're going to invest as a country, we should be investing in our engagement with Asia, because that is where our exports are going to go in the future.
Yeah.
And I agree with John. I think that's really what we've got to work hard on, because the gravy train that it is, the mining industry, is only going to last another decade. And if we don't spend that wisely, we're going to go back into a boom-bust cycle.
Yeah. And maybe I'll give you the last word, John, on China and Asia. Are we just too reliant on them? Are we smart enough to not be too reliant on them?
Should take advantage of the great gift that they offer. That is that within the decade, China's already the second biggest economy in the world. Within the decade, will be the biggest, and the entire Asian economic community will be not only the biggest producer in the world, but the biggest consumer. This is a great opportunity for us, which I don't think we can make enough of.
Okay, unfortunately, we're going to have to call it quits there. I'm sure you're desperate to go and grab your 20 minutes worth of coffee. So would you like to thank our two speakers, John Edwards and Chris Ryan? Thank you.